It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today, it's the Hip Chick's Guide to Macrobiotics. This philosophical approach to eating is making a comeback since its first flush in the 1970s. Macrobiotic chef Jessica Porter brings us a kinder, gentler approach to balancing our yin and yang. While the Sterns are into fried chicken, scripture boxes, and lava lights at the Beacon Light Tea Room, wine maverick Josh Wesson has the latest red grape on the scene, Primitivo. New York food guy Mike Colomeco covers breakfast in Manhattan, and Esquire food columnist Francine Marukian talks the real difference between cooking for a friend and cooking for a lover. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this.
Thank you.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by Super Target. Today, it's a woman who's bucking a trend. Now, in a world obsessed with Atkins and low carbohydrates, Jessica Porter has come out with her book, The Hip Chick's Guide to Macrobiotics. It's a fresh look at this philosophical, grain-based approach to eating. Wine maverick Josh Wesson has a new bargain red to check out, Italy's Primitivo. We get the skinny on breakfast in Manhattan, where the power folk go and where to just hang loose. Then Esquire's food columnist Francine Marukian plays Iconoclast, the real take on cooking for lovers and friends. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. So let's start things off the way we do each week with Jane and Michael Stern, brought to you by Starbucks, a passion for the perfect cup. The Sterns do the road food column in Gourmet Magazine.
Lynn, you've heard us talk about the great country ham and fried chicken served at the Loveless Cafe in Nashville, Tennessee. Well, we found a restaurant 40 miles west of Nashville where that meal originated. The Beacon Light Tea Room was run by the man who started the Loveless Cafe. He was run out of the county where the Beacon Light Tea Room was for moonshining, went to Nashville and started the Loveless. However, he left behind the Beacon Light Tea Room serving the same really wonderful classic Southern fried chicken and country ham dinners.
I don't think he left behind any moonshine. At least we weren't given
any. Oh, absolutely not. It's a very proper place. In fact, so proper that each table is set with a, what do you call it?
I think they call it a scripture bread box?
Yes, it's shaped in, it's a tiny loaf of plastic loaf of bread in
right.
which are little cards with sayings from the Bible on them.
Kind of like a fortune cookie, but made out of plastic bread.
Or you can
if this makes sense.
You can pick the grace that you would like to say before you eat.
Exactly.
And it's all done
now,
for you.
I mean, the whole decor of the Beacon Tea Room really won us over because in addition to great ham with red eye gravy.
Not as decor. This is on the plate.
Yeah, right. The ham is not on the wall. But they have, it's kind of a combination of pictures of Jesus and lots of lava lights. So it's kind of an eerie religioso decor with great ham and hash brown casserole.
Now, wait a minute. Back up.
I think Lynn is speechless.
No, well, I am, but, you know, everybody believes, right, in something different. But what's a hash brown casserole?
Oh, it's wonderful. It's kind of like, I guess, similar to scalloped potatoes, not quite as juicy. It's hash browns but that are fried and then baked. And they make a wonderful companion to country ham, which served, of course, with red eye gravy and cream gravy and warm biscuits throughout the meal.
Now, I know you're not supposed to do this, but they also have the best homemade blackberry preserve there. And I actually did spoon some onto the hash brown casserole. You're supposed to only put it on the biscuits, but it just enhances everything.
Oh, that blackberry jam is on hash brown casserole? Yeah, I'm with you. Okay.
Uh-huh.
Do they do anything else? I mean, you've got the ham and you've got fried chicken, right?
Virtually nothing. No, you go there for either country ham or fried chicken. I think you can get ham biscuits. In other words, if you don't want the slab of country ham, you can get biscuits in which are slices of ham. But other than ham and chicken, that's it.
It's one of those great places where there's virtually no menu. I mean, everybody who goes there knows what they serve. And if you don't want ham and you don't want fried chicken, then move on and go somewhere else.
If you're looking for a chef salad, this is not the place to be.
This is not the place.
Okay. Hey, guys, thank you.
Okay, Lynn, take care.
Bye-bye.
Stick shifts and safety belts. Bucket seats have all got to go when we're driving. In the car, it makes my baby seem so far. I need you here with me, not way over in a bucket seat. I need you to be here with me, not way over in a bucket seat.
parents are authors of that indispensable guide, Road Food. Now, they're here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. Now, talking about Tennessee and ham, I was just in Nashville hanging out with a group of pork researchers, and let me tell you, I had a blast. Now, they asked me to design a menu for them and to give a talk. Now, I figured the menu should be all about the parts of the pig most people snub, and I found a chef who was right there with me. Sean Brock of the Hermitage Hotel in Nashville is the man. I mean, this guy lives and breathes pig. We came up with six pork dishes, including dessert, which was a peach pie with a lard crust, the best of which was, well, just haven't had anything that good in years. Anyway, we did country ham, we did pork rinds Mexican style, we did Italian fatback, we did local bacon in the salad, but the star of the meal was the biggest surprise, even for these guys who live with the pig. Sean did his southern foie gras. Now that's pork belly, slow roasted about 6 to 8 hours until it's practically melted. Then he presses it overnight. He cuts it in squares, and to serve it up, he takes a searing hot skillet, flips in that pork belly, and browns it until the aroma could make a grown man weep like a baby. Me and my pork buddies, we just licked our plates. Joshua Wesson is my kind of guy. He's a maverick. He's a wine sommelier turned bargain hunter. Josh went from convincing his customers that $200 a bottle was a mere pittance to hunting down wines for around 10 bucks a bottle. He's the co-creator of Bestsellers Wine Shops, and he's one of our regulars. Josh, good to have you back.
Good to be here. Always good to be here.
You know, I've been seeing a grape mentioned on labels. Primitivo? What do you know about Primitivo?
Well, I know a lot about Primitivo because it's one of my favorite red grapes. It's a grape that's grown extensively in southern Italy, primarily in the heel of the Buddha, Puglia. And it's, I think, the seventh or eighth most widely planted grape in all of Italy. So it gets a lot of respect down in the south. But it got its name because it tends to ripen on the early side of red grapes. It's sort of, you know, the primitive, the first, the primal grape down there. And it produces wines that are full of flavor. They're rich. They're heady. They have a connection to bramble fruits like raspberries. And they're usually high in alcohol, but they're fun to drink, and they don't need to be aged, which is one of the greatest attributes of Primitivos from southern Italy. You can drink them while they're young and enjoy them every bit as much as you would if they were 3, 4, 5 years old.
And it tends to be a light-bodied red, usually?
No, it's one of those chameleon grapes that can be made into a fairly light red wine, but it's never super light like a Beaujolais would be like. But most of the time, it comes in the form of a medium-bodied to full-bodied red wine. It doesn't have a heap of tannin, but it does have a lot of flavor and a fair amount of alcohol. And it has been connected to Zinfandel for years, but it was recently proven, in fact, to be exactly the same grape as Zinfandel, which shocked many a California winemaker. But Primitivo and Zinfandel are one in the same.
I had always heard that Zinfandel was the California grape. It didn't come from anywhere else. It was a native. That's interesting. Huh.
Yeah. You know, there are all sorts of stories and lore about Zinfandel and how it was brought from Hungary in the 1850s. But, you know, one of the most interesting things about this grape, whether you call it Primitivo or Zinfandel, is that it was grown in New York State before it ever got to California. Its origins came from Europe, from Croatia, in fact. It's related to a grape called Krilljanek, but the grape was dragged over and planted in New York in the early 1800s, only then taken out to California, where everybody thinks it's the California grape. But in fact, it was grown in New York before it was in California.
Well, going back to your Italy base, any favorites, any recommendations?
Yeah, you know, I mean, back down in Apulia, where, you know, Primitivo is king, just like Sangiovese rules Tuscany, Primitivo's the horse you want to bet on down there. There are so many wines that are in the $10 to $20 range that are just astoundingly good. I think for Zinfandel lovers, calling all Zinfandel lovers, stop looking at California, look at Apulia, go get a bottle of Amano. Which is $10. It's A-M-A-N-O, and it will hold its own with many a $15 to $20 Zinfandel from California. And it's got all of that lush fruit, plummy, rich, without the tannins. It goes with a lot of different foods, and it's just fun to drink on its own. I love wines like that.
Anything else?
If you want to step up another $2 or $3, you can get into an estate bottled Primitivo from Botramagno, a very good producer. And a lot of the grapes, of course, in Apulia are old vines. They are old vines because they've been there a long time,
yeah,
not old vines because somebody decided that was a nice title that would sell more and that they could charge more. So you can get inexpensive old vines wine there. The Botramagno is $12. And if you want to step all the way up to the Cadillac, the Mercedes-Benz of Primitivos, get a Rosa del Golfo, Primitivo del Salento. Just say Rosa del Golfo, and it's just, it's as good as any $25, $30 Zinfandel. It's just fabulous. It's deep. It's soulful. It will make you speak a form of Croatian, I'm sure, that you didn't have any.
And I've been looking for that for a long time. Hey, Josh, thank you.
Thanks.
Wine Authority, Josh Wesson is co-creator of Bestsellers Wine Shops. Now, we posted Josh's Primitivo wine picks on the site, splendidtable.org. And while you're on the site, check out our weekly newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. Now, it's brought to you by the farmers of Organic Valley. Every week, we send you a new recipe, shopping, and technique tips. And thanks to those cows, it's free. You can register for it online, splendidtable.org. Coming up, a hip chick's guide to macrobiotics and doing the power breakfast in Manhattan. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget, home of Archer Farms, where you can find modern takes on old-time classics like angel food cake, quiche, and garlic bread. Find them online at target.com/SuperTarget. Talk about bucking a trend. If the Atkins no-carb craze were a rushing river, macrobiotics would be the lone salmon leaping its way upstream. But the salmon is attracting followers. This meatless philosophical approach to eating that began in the 70s is making a comeback. Now, proof of this landed on my desk a while back, a book by Jessica Porter. Jessica is a macrobiotic chef and teacher, and she trained at America's Macrobiotic Center, the Cushing Institute in Beckett, Massachusetts. Her book is The Hip Chick's Guide to Macrobiotics. Jessica, welcome.
Thank you so much, Lynn. It's great to be here.
So, Jessica, the title tells me perhaps things are changing in the world of macrobiotics. I mean, this doesn't feel the way macrobiotics felt back in the 70s. It was kind of stern back then.
Yeah, well, you know, about 10 years ago when I was working at the Cushy Institute, and I was so turned on by this food and so turned on by the ideas, and I was about 25 years old, mm-hmm. and I remember thinking to myself, if only Madonna were macrobiotic, this whole thing would just explode. And of course, at the time, it was the most ridiculous thought. And then, you know, about 5 years ago, Madonna actually became macrobiotic. So there's this whole, maybe I manifested that, I don't know. There's a whole celeb contingent. And when Madonna and Gwyneth Paltrow got into macrobiotics, it started popping up in the press. And I knew that there were a bunch of women out there that were hearing this word, possibly for the first time, but certainly for the first time in a cool context. And I wanted to write to them and say, this is what they're doing.
Well, can you define it? What is it?
Well, it's a great question. And you could answer it about a thousand different ways. But this is how I'll do it. First of all, macrobiotics is not just a diet. It's a philosophy. It's, in fact, a cosmology. And it's based on the idea that the universe is being created at all times by two basic forces. One force we call yin, one we call yang, and they are basically contraction and expansion. And if we look at the human body, that's evident. Like, my heart expands and contracts. My lungs expand and contract. My mm-hmm. intestines expand and contract. If you look in someone's eyes, you can see their pupils expanding and contracting, which tells you about their whole nervous system. So in macrobiotics, the food part is that we choose to follow that natural template of expansion and contraction. And you can eat like candy bars and power bars like made in factories, but their expansion contraction template is way off the natural chart. And when you push your body way off the natural chart, you're basically asking for problems, and not just physical problems, but emotional and mental problems too. So the macrobiotic diet is trying to bring us back down to nature's template, and then we just automatically get rid of some of the crazy yucky stuff that we've developed over time.
So what do we eat?
Well, that's another good question. The principal food in macrobiotics is whole grains. And it's been very interesting because Dr. Atkins has, one of the things that the Atkins diet has done incredibly successfully mm-hmm. is within a couple of years, it has educated the Western world that sugar and white flour and refined carbohydrates are not only not good for you, they're just not food at all. But the problem is they've defined carbs as kind of this one big kit and caboodle of bad things. Mm-hmm. And the truth is there's good quality complex carbohydrates, and that's the principal food in macrobiotics. So whole grains, locally grown vegetables, usually in season, mm-hmm. some vegetable quality protein like beans or tofu or tempeh, but also some fish. It's not a completely vegan diet. Sea vegetables, a little bit of fruit, some sweets like barley malt and rice syrup and yummy stuff like that, mm-hmm. condiments, pickles, and non-aromatic teas. And it also does not completely exclude alcohol.
Well, okay, can you give me, as an example of how this works, a little lesson, a menu? What would be your supper, a typical simple supper?
Well, considering we're getting into fall, mm-hmm. And the body is beginning to contract in the fall, we
right.
need sort of more warming things, more settling, calming things. We're coming back into our homes after having been out for a long time. If I were to make a full bells and whistles macrobiotic meal tonight, I would start with squash soup, which is so easy. The hardest part of squash soup is picking a good squash. And that can be hard, as you know, like
yes.
thumping and smelling and
yeah,
looking and
right,
touching.
Right.
You find a nice sweet squash, make that into squash soup, which is incredibly simple. Then I would make some basmati rice with maybe some corn kernels in it. This is the time of year, Lynn, where the sweet taste predominates. It's a very sweet and settling time of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would make these things called black-eyed pea croquettes, which are soaked black-eyed peas that you whiz in a food processor and then you deep fry them with some cumin.
Mm. Now, what you mean, you just...
Did you hear that all the way in Minnesota?
Yeah. You don't cook them, you just soak them?
Isn't that weird? I mean, the deep frying is the cooking.
Oh, wow.
But,
sounds
but
great.
Yeah, and they're great. And then I make this barley malt mustard sauce to put on them.
Uh-huh.
Then I would make a big old mess of leafy greens, maybe a red radish pickle to give it some red on the plate, because mm-hmm. when you want to balance all the colors. And then for dessert, I would make poached pears with ginger glaze and almond cream, and then some kukicha tea.
Sounds great to me. Hey, Jessica, thank you.
Well, thank you.
Jessica Porter is a macrobiotic chef and author of The Hip Chick's Guide to Macrobiotics. Now, you can find Jessica's recipes for squash soup and black-eyed pea croquettes on the website, splendidtable.org. And when you're shopping for Jessica's recipe, try out some of the newer winter squashes. I mean, every time I shop, I see new ones on the pile. Now, at my last tally, the sweetest squashes were the kombucha. Now, this is dark green, looks like a pumpkin. The delicata. This is kind of a long oval. It's pale yellow, has green stripes. The little dumpling, golden nugget, kimakuri, and buttercup, which, of course, is yellow. Now, do take any unfamiliar squashes home for a test drive. Since roasting deepens and sweetens the taste of any vegetable, I roast the newbies to see what each one is like. Now, any of them can wait in the refrigerator to go into soup, or you can mash them like sweet potatoes. I mean, this is where good cinnamon, a little butter, and a tad of garlic really shine. Now, the other thing that I do with sweet squash is make pumpkin pie, which I guess now should be called sweet squash pie. Roasted sweet dumpling squash, that could put the pumpkin out of business. When you want to know eating in New York City, one person to go to is Chef Mike Colomeco. On his PBS program, Colomeco's Food Show, he covers the city food scene from eating on the cheap in Hell's Kitchen to going behind kitchen doors of great restaurants. Mike, it is great to have you back.
Lynn, wonderful to be back.
So, Mike, you know, you go to New York to eat dinner. I mean, people plan for dinner and that kind of thing, but very few people think about breakfast. Where is everybody eating breakfast these days?
Lynn, I drive my family nuts. I think about breakfast, lunch, and dinner. You're missing the show if you just come to New York to eat dinner, because breakfasts are great and there's phenomenal lunches. But we're going to kind of do a tour from uptown to downtown
okay.
for breakfast. One of my favorite spots of all times is on the Upper West Side, Barney Greengrass. It is a fish delicatessen that's been there since the 30s. Grandpa, then his son, and now the grandson, Gary, runs it. And it's phenomenal. I mean, it should be everyone's reference point. If you want to taste the best smoked salmon, the best sable, the best whitefish and whitefish salad, sturgeon to die for, bagels, bialys, borscht, and chopped liver, this place is it. And, you know, I eat around New York all the time, and I've talked to the Gary, the owner, about why it's better, and he just says, Mike, I buy the best. I spend the money, and I buy the best. And I think he's right. It's just the cut above. He's great. He does mail order too, but if you're on the Upper West Side, you have to go in. And the place is a hoot. It hasn't, you know, like I said, they opened in the 30s. Mm-hmm. I think that's the last time they renovated it. It's just this authentic slice of old New York deli-dom, but absolutely worth the trip.
Okay, so that's the bagel and lox, but I may be behind the curve. Is the power breakfast still going strong?
Oh, is there ever, you know. It reminds me of when I was in high school. You know, you walk into the cafeteria and the first day, and what table are you going to sit at, right? Well, you got the jocks, the nerds, the hippies, and everyone kind of finds it. Well,
yeah.
Go 20 years ahead, and these are the A-type driven folks who, the day can't start early enough in Manhattan for these people to do deals. So, you know, they get up at 5 o'clock, go to the gym, get their nails done, do their hair, put on the $3,000 suits, and breakfast is the first appointment of the day. The Regency Hotel's always been great, but one of my favorites is Michael's on West 55th Street, where by 8 or 8:30, it's just packed. You could cut the energy in the air. It's just, you know, guys and women, and these are people at the top of their professions, real estate, banking, publishing, and they're just doing deals and eating great food, not for nothing. The food's wonderful, but I just go there for the show.
So tell me, what about brunch? I mean, does anybody do brunch in New York? Is it still going?
They still do. For the most part, it's relegated to weekends, Saturday or Sunday. But if you're there any day, 7 days a week in the Meridian Hotel, you got to go to Norma's. The place is nuts. This is like brunch on steroids. They have a section of the menu called Mom Can't Make This at Home or something, and they've got an item called a waza, question mark. That's what it's called. And you're like, well, what is it? Well, they didn't know what to call it either. It's basically a huge waffle. waffle studded with fruit, with sliced fruit on the top, topped with a strawberry hollandaise sauce, then dusted with sugar, goes under the salamander, so it comes out bruleed, and when it gets to the table, it looks like something out of Flash Gordon. You know, it's like a flying saucer. They do a chocolate brioche French toast, they make a chocolate brioche that's great. Uh-huh. They cut pockets in it, stick a Valrhona ganache in the center of that. You cut it open, and it just oozes. I mean, everything at they do a hash with duck confit. I mean, everything's like that, and they have the $1,000 omelet.
This is the place with the $1,000 omelet. What is it exactly?
You know, in the town of $50 hamburgers, I guess somebody had to do a $1,000 omelet. But what is it? It's 10 ounces of Sevruga caviar, I guess a whole Maine lobster that's been cooked and chopped up, and your next month's mortgage payment. I'm sure it's wonderful. I've never had it. And I asked them, I said, do you really sell these things? And the manager said, we've sold 7 since June. So I guess there's people out there.
Yeah, I also don't know if I tell my banker that this is the way I was going to make my living.
or your kids.
Yeah, exactly.
Around the corner from that is the exact opposite. It's a little Parisian cafe called Petrosian Cafe that I love. It's everything Norma's isn't, but I'm not knocking anybody. It's tiny. It offers a real slice of French pastry, perfect croissant, perfect pain au chocolat, great brioche, Greek yogurt with homemade muesli and some kind of wonderful honeys. If you want to taste baked goods that are really, really done right, tiny little muffins and financiers that are just the perfect example of them. You know, there's baking and there's baking. These aren't the muffins on steroids we're used to seeing that are the size of bowling pins. These are delicate. They're cooked through to the center, and everything that they use is natural. I've been in the kitchen downstairs. Catherine is the French baker. She's superb. It's probably my favorite. It's quiet, too. It's a good place to repair in the mornings.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Lynn. And we'll do lunch sometime.
I'd rather do breakfast at this point. Chef and food importer Mike Colomeco covers the New York food scene on his PBS series, Colomeco's Food Show. It airs on Channel 13 in New York City. Now, for information on Mike's breakfast picks, go to the website, splendidtable.org. You gotta love a woman who says there's no such thing as bad bacon. The woman is Francine Marukian. She's a former New York caterer, former director of special events for Dean and DeLuca. Now she is columnist for Esquire magazine. Her focus is food and the single man. Her book is Esquire Eats, How to Feed Your Friends and Lovers. Francine, welcome.
Hi, Lynn.
So, Francine, who are you talking to with this book?
Well, when I wrote Esquire Eats, I was really writing it to two people, the editor-in-chief of Esquire, David Granger, and Brendan Vaughn, who's my own editor there, mostly because they asked me lots of questions about food, and I wanted to answer them all at one time.
Now, they're both men.
Totally. They represent the Esquire reader to me, the sort of urban, no matter where you live, the sort of urban sensibility, guy who's, you know, probably mid-30s to late 40s or early 50s, interested in lots of different things, and certainly interested in cooking.
What are the big issues for the single person, let's say?
I think the biggest issue that single people have to get over is the fact that entertaining is a couple's activity. Single people feel like they shouldn't be entertaining alone, and that they won't be able to do it, that they won't be able to pull it off. And that's just not true. You can do it all. You can invite the people, you can make good conversation, and you can make dinner. You just have to know how to get yourself structured in order for that to happen. You have to have a framework for it to happen.
Well, you talk about in the book about strategies and about mindsets. Mm-hmm. And I'd love for you to explore that a bit, about the misconceptions that we have about entertaining.
Sure. I think the first one ties into what I was just saying. There's a certain level of artifice that people assume when they entertain in their homes. They think that everything has to be perfect instead of comfortable. They think that food has to be fancy, and if you could see me, I'd be making little quote marks around that word.
Mm-hmm,
when just simple and delicious, classic food is anything that's well made is always appreciated. And they think that there has to be some sort of polish on the evening that isn't that the kind of polish that you get when you go to a restaurant. Many people in the age group of men who start to entertain at home for the first time in their, let's say, mid-30s to early 40s, mm-hmm. they're very restaurant savvy. They know nothing about entertaining at home. Those are two separate things. Your home isn't a restaurant.
So you're saying, don't try to do the restaurant food. Don't try to do that chef's menu from the cookbook.
And forget garnish. Garnish is out. No painting your plates, no sprinkling of, you know, herbs around the outside, no dusting of cayenne pepper.
But now, wait a minute. This is a big question, because I think today when you look at magazines, mm-hmm. style is everything. I mean, it's how the plate looks. It's stacking the food. It's, mm-hmm. You know, everything has to be beige and sage green. Or, mm-hmm. And I think people really go over the top with this stuff. So you're saying ignore all that?
Well, I'm saying it's just like looking at a photograph of a celebrity in a magazine. Do you really think if you use the same shampoo, your hair is going to look exactly the same? It is not. Food has been styled, it's been buffed, it's been polished, it's been designed, it's been art directed, it's been lit from within and lit from underneath and photographed. And then if it doesn't look perfect, it's photoshopped before it lands in the magazine. If you don't have, you know, 20 other people working on your dinner with you in your kitchen, it's not going to look like that. And I think that's sad that people mistake lifestyle and real life.
Is there a difference between cooking for lovers and for friends?
Well, totally, because cooking for lovers is you really don't want any amount of domesticity to show. There are certain dishes, you know, I always say I am the mistress of the make-ahead meal. Because, you know, I want someone to think that it takes no effort whatsoever in the beginning. That's
in the beginning.
But yes, but, you know, like one day all of a sudden I always say the day that the flannel must fall. You know, there's like a day when you've been wearing great lingerie and all of a sudden it's really cold and you just need your pajamas. Same thing with food.
Francine, thank you.
Sure. Thank you, Lynn.
Writer Francine Mourouchian is columnist for Esquire magazine. She's author of Esquire Eats, How to Feed Your Friends and Lovers. Now, you can get her recipe for double fried porterhouse with classic steakhouse rub on the website, splendidtable.org. Well, it's time for our weekly trivia challenge. Now, here's the question. How did the porterhouse steak get its name? Now, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget, one-stop shopping for groceries, cookware, and entertaining. You can visit them online at target.com/SuperTarget. Well, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, how did the porterhouse steak get its name? Well, the name goes back to the early 1800s. It was named for the porterhouses, or the taverns where stagecoaches stopped. Now, this was mainly on the East Coast. They served porter-style ale and meat. Now, supposedly, a man running a porterhouse in New York City started calling this luxury cut porterhouse. Now, the great thing about a porterhouse steak is that it is really two steaks in one. On one side of the bone, you've got the long triangle of the short loin. Fabulous eating. On the other side is a big hunk of filet mignon. For my money, not as tasty, but pretty tender. A 2-inch thick porterhouse steak is perfect for sharing. And to me, this is what steak's all about. The lines are officially open. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's see. Who is waiting patiently? We have Linda on the line from Bend, Oregon. Linda, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hi. Well, what I want to talk about is homemade mozzarella cheese. I was traveling a lot one year, and back in the East Coast, there was a cute little bar, and the bartender every night served fresh mozzarella.
Where is the bar?
I don't know. I can't remember. We went to so many places, and I just thought, what a neat thing. And I said, this must be very time-consuming. Not at all. He said, it's so easy. And I've never seen a recipe for fresh homemade mozzarella.
So you want to know how to make it yourself, then?
Right.
Okay. There is nothing like fresh-made mozzarella. And in Italy, the great mozzarella makers tell you that mozzarella has 24 attributes, and it loses one per hour.
Oh, my.
So the idea is you really are supposed to eat it fresh. And a great one, and this is probably what you had, is whatever form it's in, a ball, a braid, or whatever, the inside of it is kind of wonderfully soft and milky.
Yes.
Yeah, it's not rubber bands.
Yes.
Now, I should tell you, this is a high craft. But there's two things that come to mind. First of all, what I am hearing from a lot of people who run shops is that the Pollio people, this is a company based on the East Coast, okay, P-O-L-L-Y, I think, dash O, just the word O. The Pollio people, which gained a big reputation for their ricotta, they sell the curd that you make mozzarella from. Okay. Do you have any idea how it's actually made?
I have a vague idea, and I thought it had something to do with rennet and, you know, exotic sheep's milk and hanging it in a bag for hours.
Nah. A little easier than that. You take water that is just below the boil, all right?
Yeah.
You drop in some of those curds. You use the long handle of a wooden spoon.
Right.
Don't let the water boil. It should be a little steamy, but not boiling.
Yeah.
And you stir for about 3 or 4 minutes, and what's going to happen is, and you keep stretching, you're going to get these wonderful stretches. And that's the art of mozzarella, is that gentle pulling and stretching. You lift that handle of the wooden spoon up, and you let it stretch and fall away. And then what you do is you only do that for a few times. You want it to be soft. And then you can take that and shape it into a ball, make it into a braid, and then you can put it into either the whey that you drained off, or, which will give it a tang, you can lightly salt it. You can put it in salted water. A lot of people just put it in water, in cold water, with a little salt in it to give it a tad of flavor. And that's the mozzarella.
That's terrific. Thanks. I enjoy your show so much.
Hey, thank you. And thanks for calling.
Hot day.
Take care.
Bye.
Goodbye, Linda. It's really not that hard. But, of course, it only takes years to get the stretching right. But, hey, we can do a reasonable facsimile. You can call us, guys, 800-537-5252. We have got Michael on the line from Pinehurst, North Carolina. That sounds so cool and idyllic, Michael, is it?
It's a beautiful little village, and we're all about golf.
Oh, my. Well, I can't be bad. Well, do you have a question?
Yes, ma'am. I was listening to a recent show, and you were talking about a Vietnamese dish, and you said, oh, let's use fish paste. And I think it was fish paste that you were talking about.
Fish sauce. Yeah.
You said, well, you know, a little goes a long way, and so I just keep it on my refrigerator door. And the thought crossed my mind. I thought, well, Lynn must have, 12 refrigerator doors? And And so I thought, you know, the interesting question I wanted to ask you as a part-time cook and probably just a weekend entertainer, what would you put in the well-tempered refrigerator, pantry, wine cabinet? How would you, what do you think are the basic essentials that, that a sort of a bachelor weekend cook might want to always keep on hand if it wasn't fish sauce? On the door.
Right. Well, you know, first of all, you got to say, what do you like to eat and what do you like to cook? That's the first thing. And do you have preferences? Like, for instance, do you tend to lean toward Italian? Do you tend to lean toward Chinese? You know what I'm saying?
Right. And I would say Italian. The chicken breast seems to be the main staple. Pasta dishes, green salads.
Then what I would have... This is a great question, by the way. I'm trying to think of a way to answer it in less than a half hour. But I guess I would have two kinds of olive oil. Now, this is if we're going to go for the broke here, right? I'd have an olive oil that was really great for drizzling and sipping and, you know, and it's going to be expensive, but you'll use very little at a time. And I would have, and that might be McAvoy Ranch from California. There's a fabulous, expensive, I mean, it's gold, but it's so good, called Castel del Rio. It's from Sicily. That tastes like, it smells like fresh cut grass. And it just tastes so fresh. And then you want to have a good basic olive oil, an extra virgin that you'd cook with. And then I'd want some good cider vinegar. I love cider vinegar. I'd have rice vinegar, a little bit of wine vinegar. I always have canned tomatoes. Now, at this time of year, I don't need them, but otherwise, I always have canned tomatoes. There is always garlic and onions, and if you're a sometime cook, you may want to store them in the fridge, but don't seal them. You know, put them loosely wrapped in the fridge.
Okay.
And you want big cloves of garlic, not elephant garlic, but don't get those fiddly little cloves. You know, they just waste your time. And the other thing I would do is I would have some soy sauce. I'd have fish sauce. I love tamarind concentrate. I make my visit, you know, like once a month to the Asian market, and I get tamarind concentrate and I get hoisin sauce and I get, anything that intrigues me that I think might be fun to throw into a quick marinade for that proverbial chicken breast. I would have ground chili, good ground chili, in the freezer or in the refrigerator. I have condiment heaven in my refrigerator. There's very little room for fresh food because of all the condiments. A great mustard. You know that the mustard that comes in the stone crock, it's called moutarde de Meaux. It's this coarse grain. I would splurge and get that. I would also, I always have Gouldens spicy dark brown mustard in my fridge. And that's what goes into salad dressings and stuff. And it's $1.89 a jar. And it's better than Grey Poupon, believe it or not.
Okay.
I think what I would also have is lots of lemons and eggs and bacon. And always wine. I'd have inexpensive, drinkable white and red wine for me and for my dishes. And then, of course, your pasta, which you've already got. And great salt. Peppercorns. Peppercorns in a pepper mill and some good sea salt.
Well, that sounds like it's got it. Now I can probably clear out a little space in the refrigerator and cupboard and go for it.
Give it a shot. See what you think.
Thanks so much.
Hey, you take care.
You too.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Reach us, guys, at 800-537-5252. We have Biddy calling from Mercer Island, Washington. Biddy, is that you? Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Did you have a question?
I do. I have a question. What I would like to know is what would be a good coffee grinder for home use that would be under $100?
Oh, boy. You know, I don't know if you've done any reading, but there's this kind of debate about coffee grinders. There's the Burr style.
Right.
You know, that's like the peppercorn,
mill.
Yeah. This is what, there's the blade type, which is like using a blender, and then there's the Burr type. And between you and me, I've tried them both, and I prefer my old 20 or 30 buck Braun or Krupp's blade coffee grinder. Because you get an awful lot of, I don't know, when you do it with a Burr grinder, I just think the coffee tastes different and I don't like it as much. And I don't care what all the experts say, that's my take. And what you want is a stainless steel interior, okay, because you can wipe it out and it doesn't keep smells and of stale coffee or anything like that.
Right.
You want a clear plastic top, and you want a coffee grinder that can hold the amount of coffee that your full coffee pot will take.
Right.
So I'd think Braun and I'd think Krupps, because those are the ones that I have really found work really well. By the way, where are you calling from? It sounds like a party.
Oh, no. I'm calling from an exercise club, and I just had a killer aerobics class. So
this is great. And now you can treat yourself to Turkish coffee with an inexpensive grinder.
Exactly.
Hey, thanks for calling.
And I love your program.
Hey, thanks a lot.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Hey, work out, listen to The Splendid Table. Life is about balances. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Let's see who is up next. We've got Andrea calling from Santa Cruz, California. Hey, Andrea, what do you want to talk about?
Hi. I would like to ask you how to cure olives. I have a fruiting olive tree. And what do I do?
You people in California, I swear. Fruiting olive tree, right?
I know.
This is great. How do you cure olives? Well, first of all, you pick them. It depends on what you're going for. You can pick them when they're not quite ripe, when they tend to be on the green side and you get more of a pucker quality. Or you can pick them when they're darker in tone, and that's when they're going to be really ripe. No bruises, no, you know, little beasties and that kind of thing, because they just won't cure. So handle them carefully. First thing you do is you wash them well. And then usually there's a lot of ways of doing this, but one of the easiest ways that I've seen done in Italy is you make a brine. And the brine is usually one part salt to two parts water. It's really an intense brine. And I'd say use kosher salt. Don't use iodized salt under any circumstances. Yeah. And so you'd mix that. You'd want to have enough that you really can cover the olives. Bring the brine to a boil, and you can throw in there, you know, something like bay leaves. You can throw in garlic. But those flavorings can also be added later. The thing is, you take the washed olives, you immerse them in the brine. You usually put something on top of them, like a heavy wooden piece or a plate. You want to keep them under the liquid.
Okay.
They have to be in a cool place, like 50 degrees, 40 degrees, and you want to leave them for about 6 weeks.
6 weeks, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have a good place for that. Now, Lynn, what about this rumor that you have to cure them in lye?
No. You can use salt, and lye is used for a fast cure.
Oh.
Yeah, and in fact, some people claim, and this is where my memory is a little weak, that lye-cured olives are really commercial olives, and they're not really all that wonderful.
That's great. I'd rather not.
Yeah,
do that anyway.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, I mean, there are ways of doing it, but quite frankly, I can't remember them. Brine is direct and it's simple. Now, once they're cured, if you want to, you know, you can pull them out, and usually they're put in a little bit of acid. You know, like vinegar, because that's usually the best idea. But you can then throw some bay leaves in there. You can throw sprigs of thyme and bits of basil to give them more flavor.
Okay. And the only thing I'm not 100% clear on is this. When you said bring it to a boil, I'm bringing the olives to a boil?
No.
Hot water? No, I'm making my brine first. Then
and
I'm
you're boiling it. You're
the raw
boiling
olives
it.
In it.
That's right. Once
Perfect.
It's cooled down. And, the other thing is it should be in a sterile container.
Okay.
So you can do it in a bunch of things, you know, but make sure they're not metal. You want something that glass works really well. Pottery that is, I would say glass or ceramic, but you want to make sure it's not a glaze that the salt's going to eat into.
Right.
Usually glass is a pretty good thing, but you want to keep it away from light and away from any real warmth.
Hey, that's great.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
So probably a dark closet in the basement.
Yeah, I've got a wine cellar. The former owners of this place were bootleggers. So.
Hey, that's great. Get a wine cellar in the bargain. Hey, enjoy the olives, Andrea.
Thank you very much, Lynn.
You
Bye.
Take care. Goodbye. Well, you can reach us, 800-537-5252. We have Seth on the line from Port Townsend, Washington. Seth, are you right on the water?
I am right on the water.
Oh, boy, am I jealous.
It's beautiful here.
What do you want to talk about?
Well, I want to talk about, this is sort of an end of the basil season question.
Uh-huh.
On a recent show, you mentioned that in ancient Roman times, no one would use basil in pesto. And I that got me to think that in the last 15 or 20 years, I have seen so many different things called pesto that had all sorts of ingredients, like kale and pumpkin. And I'm just wondering, are any of these, would any Italians call them pesto, or do they have any basis in Italian cooking, traditional cooking?
Well, technically, the term pesto comes from the verb pestare, what means to pound. Because traditionally, you know, pesto is made in a mortar and pestle. That's how it's made. It's crushed. And the thing I was talking about back in the Roman times, there was a superstition that basil was an herb that you didn't want to eat.
Yeah.
And one of our listeners, a professor of the classics, had sent me a translation of a poem from Virgil in ancient Rome, talking about a peasant making pesto, going to the garden and taking the garlic and the coriander. Wasn't that interesting? I mean, that fresh coriander was used. But when you're talking classic pesto today in Italy, the sauce that everybody thinks of, it's done with basil, and technically it only should come from one place. It should come from the city of Genoa, and really from a tiny suburb of the city of Genoa, because the Italians in that part of the world believe that the very best basil grows in that area. And it's, you know, food is all about microclimate. And it's so interesting because I tell you, you know, traveling in the region is Liguria, and Genoa's the capital of it. The basil's different from one place to another. Maybe the same seed, but you know, you grow it on a hillside, you grow it in your garden, you grow it where the ground is different, it tastes different.
Yeah.
But the key to true basil is young basil and pounded in a mortar and pestle with, first you start out with garlic and salt, you pound that, you start adding the basil, a little bit of olive oil, and finally some cheese. All those other things are what you would call in Italian fantasia. They're fantasies, they're improvisations, and they're valid, but they are not the traditional pesto.
Well, in recent years, there's been such an explosion of ingredients, it's hard not to improvise.
Exactly. Hey, thanks for a great question.
Well, thank you very much.
You are welcome.
Bye-bye.
You take care. Well, that's the show for this week, everyone. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. And this week, let me leave you with this thought from Mark Twain. He said, "To eat is human, to digest divine." The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget. Everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And don't miss out on our free weekly newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. We send you a new recipe every week along with shopping and technique tips. Register for it online, splendidtable.org. Additional support for our program comes from Starbucks. From coffee farmer to their roasters to your barista, craft, creativity, and passion are poured into every cup. Our producer is Sally Swift with help from Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Julia Schrankler. Have a great week. Join us next time. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.